Think about the colors in a pretty sunset, the kind you want to stand and watch for a while. I mean, sure, we can get all technical about moisture and dust and ice crystals in the atmosphere, but the point is this, those colors are completely natural. We'll talk natural colors and fabrics in this hour. The fashion business is growing more aware over time of its general non-sustainability, and the concern extends to a greater awareness of where the colors for fabrics come from. We get an education on natural color sources in the book True Colors, World Masters of Natural Dyes and Pigments. It's by Keith Recker, who is all about color. He's a color trend consultant for Pantone. He's the founder and editor of Hand Eye Magazine and the creative director of the International Folk Art Market for just a few of his jobs. Keith Recker lives and works off the eastern end of Long Island in Shelter Island, New York. Keith, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure.
For the people who have heard of Pantone and the matching system but don't quite understand it, what is it all about?
Well, the Pantone matching system was founded by a brilliant guy named Larry Herbert in the early 70s. And he, as a printer, was a little tired of having clients complain that the color coming off the press didn't match exactly their expectation. So he developed a series of printing ink formulas that would guarantee the same color as specified, and it made for a world of happier printers and designers and really caught on and became a major force in the design industry.
Wow, sounds like painstaking work on his part and the people he hired to help him with the work.
Yes, sir.
So as a trend consultant, do you counsel Pantone on what's likely to become popular?
Yes, that is part of the work that we do together. My job is to look 2 and 3 and 4 years into the future to identify what consumers are going to be hungry for, what their moods will be, what their interests will be, some of the challenges they might feel, and to translate that into colors, textures, motifs, and forms that they will find interesting.
That sounds like a process that could go from zero to infinity quickly. I mean, there are just so many things to take in. I mean, socially, culturally, politically, you name it.
That's true. It's a glorious wormhole. I will confess that I start my day every day reading at least 3 newspapers just to kind of stay steeped and informed about what today feels like. And then I have to use my senses and conversations and advice and try to formulate an idea of what's coming.
So figuring out what the moods will be and the colors that go with that, I have to assume that's gotten a little harder over time, not just because the world is more complicated and full of more information, but the preface in your book also talks about more discernment about color.
Yes, it's true. It's true. People, one of the advantages of the age of the glorious internet is that people are better informed, you know, perhaps only to a certain level, but people are better informed about the bigger issues of the day and what may or may not influence movement in those bigger issues. So people increasingly are super aware that fashion has been described as the second most polluting industry in the world, just behind oil and mining. And part of the problem is the way things are made, what they're made of, as well as just general consumer behavior about us going for cheap goods that we wear for a very short period of time. I came across a statistic the other day that said we are consuming clothing at a rate 5 times greater than that of the 80s, and that any given garment is likely to find its way to landfill within a year of purchase.
Wow, that's a short lifespan for a piece of clothing. And is it made somewhat worse by synthetic fabrics, synthetic dyes?
It's not helped. Let's put it that way. It's not helped. I think overall, we have work to do on both ends of the spectrum. We have work to do on the production side with what goes into the garment, how it's produced, how the waste is dealt with, as well as on the demand side, which has to do with what we value, how we behave, what kind of product we endorse, how long we care for it and wear it, and what we do with it when we're done with it.
So, Keith, before we get into talking about the natural pigments, let's talk about the non-natural pigments that are prevalent today. Are those just created with combining chemicals?
Yes, indeed. Synthetic dyes have been with us since 1856 with the invention of Mauveine, a really beautiful synthetic dye made from coal tar in England. And England, France, and Germany got very much into the creation of aniline dyes in the intervening decades. And synthetic dyes really took over the world in a very short period of time. I found a pamphlet written by a British woman in 1930 which was already bemoaning the near complete loss of natural color knowledge. And very interesting how quickly that took place all around the world. All around the world, even in rural Mexico, synthetic dyes were making their presence known in the 19-teens and 20s with a pretty much near-total eclipse of natural color in the decades that followed.
So some of the practices you follow in the book, True Colors, I mean, are these practices that disappeared and have been revived, or have they generally just kept going, just sort of eking along in the background while the rest of the world was buying synthetics?
In many cases, these practices did disappear and have had to be revived. And in some cases, they were so relevant to the culture that was making them that they just couldn't be supplanted by synthetic dyes. The symbolic value, the cultural value, the role that gathering the dye stuffs played in the community's annual calendar, you know, it just couldn't be done away with. It overall had too much richness and importance to the people who were making it. So I cover 26 chapters in the book. So that's about 27, 28 natural dye artists. And we do come across a whole array of stories, right? From cultural revival to cultural continuum to brand new explorations of dye stuffs, and often for very different reasons, too.
A couple seconds to a break here. I just want to ask if we know when in history people first started using pigments and dyes.
Oh, that's a great question. We know of an archaeological find not far from the Ural Mountains of hand-twisted flax twine, mostly white from the flax, but some of it was tinted a light blue. That's well over 30,000 years old.
So we mentioned 30,000 years ago, there's evidence that we started using pigments and tints. And how far and wide and unusual have we ranged in search of things, Keith, that will give us colors?
Well, I would say if you look at indigo, which is one of the natural dye substances that never quite disappeared from use, thanks in part to blue jeans, we have evidence of ancient indigo from India that stretches back 3,000 years, from Peru that stretches to 6,500 years, Egypt also about as ancient, West Africa. There's a huge evidence that this not very easy to understand indigo practice, and we can talk about that in a second, really spread all over the world. I think our fascination with making things beautiful and the kind of magic that happens in the dye pot spread this throughout the world.
So for the people who never thought about where these pigments come from, are they mostly from plants, from animals, from the ground itself?
Yes, we in the book I talk about all three options. So indigo comes from a plant. The plant in indigo that spread out through the old world, so quote-unquote the old world, is Indigofera tinctoria. But there are about three dozen species of plants that will produce indigo. And what I meant by it being not very easy to understand is that while you might be able to squeeze a stem of most of these plants and get a little bit of blue juice on your fingers, that's not a dye. That's not a water-soluble dye that fabric can soak up and incorporate into its fibers. You have to break down the cell walls of that plant to release the chemical. And then you have to get that chemical called indigotin into a dye vat with a fermentation element, so bacteria. And what the fermentation does is it starts to reduce the level of oxygen in the vat, right? Because the bacteria are using up the oxygen. And in the absence of oxygen, this indigotin breaks into indoxal, which is sometimes called white indigo, and a sugar. And the vat turns a sort of weird brown-green color. And then when you dip the fabric or fiber into that vat, the pigment will take up onto the fiber. And you draw it out, and it is kind of an unpleasant browny, snotty green. And it will oxidize. The pigment takes up the oxygen it's been deprived of and turns blue again. And it's an amazing substance because it wraps itself around the fibers. If you go home and look at your worn-out blue jeans, you will see that the blue is generally going before the fiber breaks, right? So the white core of the fiber still maintains. And that's why indigo is so beautiful, I think, because the light is reflecting back through that coat of indigo from the white fiber. So it has a gleam, it has a glow. It's an amazing substance, but not uncomplicated.
No, not at all. And in fact, as you reveal the process in the book, it looks almost like winemaking. And the more you talk about the sugars and the oxygen, it sounds very much like winemaking.
It is. I was talking to a natural dyer friend of mine named India Flint, who's the subject of a chapter in the book, about, well, how do you think this got started? This is so far from automatic and intuitive. And she said, well, here's how I imagine it. In Neolithic times, some mom who just, you know, like all moms, had to be multitasking, left her baby in a diaper by a slightly warm fire, you know, so there'll be ashes there. And the baby, of course, wet its little nappy. And there might have been some decomposing or half-charred remnant of an indigo leaf. And when mom picked up the baby, it had purple spots on its diaper. And I think mom was probably a total genius to be able to kind of retrace what had made that happen and figure out how to apply it with control. And as I mentioned, you know, the archaeological evidence suggests that we did that quite some time ago as a species.
Keith Recker, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, R-E-C-K-E-R. His book is True Colors, World Masters of Natural Dyes and Pigments. I want to come back to your own story with color. It sounds like a fascination from early in life.
Yes, it's true. It's really true. I have to admit, I have a little touch of synesthesia, which means that when I see a color, I often also smell a smell and hear a sound.
Wow.
And, you know, of course, that could be the sign of craziness, but for me, it was a sign of a real attachment and enjoyment and increasingly an understanding of color and what it means to people. For me, every shade of color tells a story. It has a narrative. And sometimes it's culturally specific, like marigolds in Oaxaca, right, as a something that calls the ancestors back to their families for the visit around the Day of the Dead time. In other cultures, you know, marigolds stand for different things. In the East, in the context of Hinduism and to some degree Buddhism, that marigold yellow stands for the flame of self-immolation, right, the purifying of the spirit, of the soul, toward the divine. So anyway, sometimes color has a culturally specific narrative, and sometimes it has more of a universal narrative.
You know, but that's a great lesson here. There's a big, oh yeah, moment for me reading this part of the book, how very different the colors can be and what they signal from culture to culture.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? And one of the things that we find is that across the world, in all languages, words for black and white or dark and light are the first color terms to enter a language. And red is always the third, where there is a third word for color, and there isn't always, almost always, but not always, red is that third color. And when you think about, you know, our nature as humans and how much red symbolizes our life and our sense of passion and our sense of vibrancy, it's very interesting that, not the color of the green nature that surrounds us, but red is the first color that enters our language system, referring to us.
That's amazing. So talking about natural colors, though, I mean, the first time someone told you you could make any Pantone color with natural dyes, how did you respond?
Well, there's a very, very nice woman named Michelle Whiplinger from Seattle who, you know, sidled up to me at a party. I was working as an executive in home merchandising at Saks Fifth Avenue, and she very confidently told me, well, I can make any color you could ever possibly want using only natural substances. You know, and I'm afraid I changed the subject. I'm afraid I had no belief whatsoever. But she was very persistent, and on her next trip to New York, she came up for a meeting and just opened four cases filled with yarn samples of every level of saturation, of every hue, of every tone. It was a mind-blowing experience, and she really opened my eyes to what was possible. As a kid, you know, coming of age in the U.S. in the 70s, of course I had zero exposure to what the possibilities of natural color would be. And it was really Michelle who turned me around and got me on a different path.
So the book ends up, as we mentioned, really a parade of people. You mentioned 27 artists. Given the possibilities out there, how did you choose the people to profile?
That's a very good question. I think really through my work with the Folk Art Market in Santa Fe, through Handeye Magazine, you know, I've spent about almost 30 years now, 28 years, in this space of bringing artists into the United States to help them succeed. So some people, like Aboubakar Fofana, the most sublime indigo master I know on a personal level, of course he had to be in there with a very important chapter. Just as Porfirio Gutierrez and his sister Juana Gutierrez Contreras from Oaxaca had to be in there to talk about their work with cochineal, which is an ancient red dye made from the dried body of a beetle. And interestingly, you know, the first reaction to red from a beetle is a little bit of ew.
Exactly.
But this red colorant is about the safest red colorant we still know of today. It's a simple carminic acid, and it's often used in cosmetics because it's so safe, as well as food coloring and, of course, natural dyeing of textiles. And its color potential is phenomenal. It's so beautiful that we had to put a double-page spread, a single photograph occupying two pages, of the 26 shades of red, orange, pink, coral, violet, and purple that Juana makes in Teotitlan del Valle with the cochineal beetle and other substances mixed in. It's just a truly spectacular spectrum.
I'm looking at the spread in front of me. It's called The Family of Reds. It's just the book is just lavishly illustrated, and it had to be, of course, with a book about colors, but that's just an amazing page. Keith Recker is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called True Colors, World Masters of Natural Dyes and Pigments. We're talking about finding dyes and pigments from nature again instead of out of vats and factories. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned Aboubakar Fofana, and his story is almost the story of the human race. He moved away from nature in a very literal sense and then came back to it.
Yes, it's true. It's true. He was taken to Paris by his family when he was about 12. He grew up in a beautiful rural part of Africa, back and forth over the border between Mali and Guinea. And his grandmother, he credits his grandmother with igniting his interest in indigo. She was a healer. And she sent him out into the forest to gather quite a few things. And one of them was the tendrils of Lonchocarpus saescens, which is known as Yoruba indigo. So it's not in the indigo for a family, but it does contain the precursors of indigo. And he noticed that when he would squish the stems, his fingers would turn blue. And he remained fascinated with it, even during his years in the suburbs of Paris, feeling very alienated from where he came from and what he most loved about his childhood. He eventually trained as an artist and chose to focus his practice on reviving West African techniques, indigo techniques. So today, fast forward to where he is right now, he farms his own indigo, makes his own indigo pigment. He farms his own cotton, spins it and weaves it into his own fabrics. He grows vegetables for the entire community that helps him on his farms and in his atelier. And he's really created, I think, through indigo, a version of the world that he lost when he was relocated to a bleak urban environment.
So he sees his work as political in addition to artistic and to clothe people. I mean, how does he see it as political?
It's a very powerful part of his current thinking. He sees cotton as an emblem of what happened to Mali in the era of colonialism. He says that Mali has forever grown cotton very, very well, very beautifully, many species with many different characteristics of fiber and length of staple and tone of color, and that in the colonial era, cotton turned into a cash crop that was sent off to Europe to be processed. So he notes that even today, several decades after independence, there's not a single cotton gin in all of Mali, even though it is their main crop. So he's commenting on the damage that was done in the colonial era and noting that there's a certain amount of capitalistic colonialism that continues in seeing people who make things in Africa as the bottom of the economic totem pole and therefore only worthy of a very small portion of the final sale price. And he points out very, very readily that the skill that goes into growing and making everything that he does is so huge that it should be the most important thing in the purchase price, not the least important thing. And he insists really on going as direct as he can to the consumer, on only cooperating with galleries and retail stores that will show him the respect that he says he needs to support himself and his community.
Does he turn out finished cloth as well as the fibers?
Yes, he does. He does. They make an amazing array of tie-dyed fabric using indigo and mud cloth. There's a fermented mud dye that he uses as well. The heritage of tie-dyed indigo fabric in Mali goes back at least to the year 1100, And we know this because of a very rare archaeological find to the northwest of the capital city of Bamako in something called the Bandiagara Escarpment. And a people called the Telem people lived in Pueblo dwellings that look a lot like Indian dwellings, Native American dwellings from the southwest. And they buried their dead in sealed clay chambers high up in the cliffs. And in these very dry conditions, sealed conditions, fabrics survived for almost 1,000 years before they were found by archaeologists in the 60s.
Wow.
And what do you think the most common dye stuff was? Indigo. Oh,
of course.
And tie-dyed beautifully, and also sophisticated wovens as well. Fabulous and rare, right, to find fabric in sub-Saharan Africa,
yeah,
from an archaeological point of view.
Keith Recker, again, our guest on The Exchange. His book is True Colors. Now, as you point out, the indigo is quite versatile. I mean, there are many, many different shades of the blues you can get from indigo, including Baga Fu. I love this, the blue of nothingness. How pale is this?
Oh, you picked my favorite color. Yeah, indigo is an amazing thing because with every dip in the vat, you can pick up another layer of pigment. So the first dip is pale, and the 12th or 14th dip is a beautiful saturated blue-black. So a whole range. And the color that you picked up on there, Baga Fu, Abu Bakar can keep an indigo vat alive with the bacteria, process of fermentation, for about 14 months. And he makes that super pale blue, the blue of nothingness, on the last day of the life of the vat. So the pigment is almost gone, the bacteria are tired, and it's this gorgeous, languorous, barely there color that is really delightful.
Oh, that's a great story, that it's just at the end of the lifespan for the indigo vat.
Yep, exactly.
So there are several more chapters of blues, not surprisingly, and you mentioned there was an indigo revolt in British India?
There was, yes. In researching the story of a group called Living Blue, which works in Bangladesh in a region called Rangpur, I came to know that when the British could no longer have access to the slave-driven indigo plantations of the Carolinas because of the American Revolution, they moved their business to their colony in Bangladesh. And slavery was illegal, but they set up a very unfortunate and cruel system of company loans, which kept indigo farmers in debt and under serious pressure. And the conditions were so bad that in 1859 and 1860, the indigo farmers and dyers revolted. And they did so in a very peaceful and respectful manner, but they were put down quite brutally. And it is said that Gandhi studied the indigo revolt and its techniques and kept them in his mind when he developed his doctrine of nonviolent protest. So it was very influential. And as a result of this political conflict, indigo was not grown in Bangladesh until quite recently, even though the plant thrives with little pest control and little care and no irrigation in the environment of Bangladesh.
And so this, go ahead. I was going to ask what the people at Living Blue do then.
Yeah. So it was a social venture founded by Care International. It involves all the farmers and the dye processors as shareholders in this social business. And they farm in the traditional manner, and they break the indigo plants down to get access to the pigment, and they process the pigment in the traditional manner, and they make among the finest indigo pigment that I know of right now. So fine, in fact, that it is used in Hermes clothing, very expensive fashion brand, as well as by many other people around the world.
So are they sustainable economically and environmentally?
Yes, they're definitely working in that direction. Indigo, because it grows so naturally in that climate and requires so little input, is, you know, of course, responsible agriculture from that point of view. It also, as a legume, puts some nitrogen back in the soil, which is great. And even the effluent, which is left over after the boiling of the pigment, can be used in the fields as fertilizer. So altogether, it contributes much more than it extracts from the economy and from nature.
We primarily focused on plants, particularly indigo so far. Let's talk about the snails of Oaxaca and what they give.
Oh, that's a fantastic story. The Mixtec people of western Oaxaca, close to the sea, have at least a 1,500-year-old tradition of taking a multi-day journey down to the ocean, just the men, to pluck sea snails called purpura panza off the black rocks of the coast, and milking them for a thimble full of what is essentially a neurotoxin that they normally use to paralyze their prey, which are little limpets. And when applied directly to a skein of cotton yarn, this gooey, icky substance oxidizes into a beautiful red-violet color. There are only 15 men left who know how to do this along the Oaxacan coast. And they bring these gorgeous skeins of yarn back to the women of their community of Pinotepa de Don Luis. And the women make gorgeous textiles combining the red violet of the sea snail, indigo, which is grown a little further south in Oaxaca, and the red of cochineal. And it is truly a gorgeous thing.
So I was thinking at first, uh-oh, here go the snails, but they're put back in the water?
They are. They are. The Mixtec have this long history of sustainable management of this resource. They see the snails as sacred, as somehow linked to an idea of divine femininity. They've observed that the female snails are larger, produce more dye stuff, and they've observed that the snails seem to require about a month to recharge. And so in this sort of beautiful symbolism and reverence, they never fish a cove of snails more than once a month, and they leave the coast during mating season so as not to interfere with the population. And this rhythm has kept the snails at a healthy level until really the intrusion of the modern world.
Wow, so the snail population does face some danger?
It does. What we see now, that tourism has reached this once remote part of the world, that local fishermen are plucking the sea snails and lots of other species and chopping them up to feed them in a ceviche to visitors. And it is really having an effect on the snail population. We may be within 5 years of losing the last shellfish purple dye left in the world.
Is the Mexican government doing anything to protect the area?
Yes, there is a community education effort underway to try to educate the fishermen about what kind of snail this is, what it means, and to not harvest it. I think like all community education efforts, that takes a little time to cement, but we're in a race with the clock.
We have a question here from one of our listeners. Let me get it up on my screen here. It's Jason in Trail wants to know if you have any thoughts about the ECOT technique that he calls crazy difficult, being invented in Japan and Southeast Asia and by ancient South American civilizations as well. He says, it's always amazed me that two cultures came up with such an exotic technique of dyeing individual thread before weaving. That again from Jason and Trail.
Well, that's a great question, Jason. And in fact, you know, ECOT also seems to have generated all by itself in Central Asia, in Indonesia, as he mentioned, in Central and South America. And no one really quite knows how this technique just appeared so separately in remote places. But it is crazy complicated. You have to sketch out your design. I've seen it happen in Uzbekistan. People stretch out the threads on a horizontal frame. They sketch out the patterns, and they tie off with, these days, plastic string, the spaces that they do not want to take up the first dip in the dye, which is generally one of the paler colors, like yellow. And then when it comes out of the yellow vat, they tie off the places that they want to remain yellow and dip it into the next color. And then they have to tie off those zones and move on. In Uzbekistan, you can have an ECOT with almost 20 shades of color, each of them requiring that step to be repeated. And keeping those threads organized so that the pattern appears when you weave it is part of the crazy complexity of the whole thing.
Because the threads themselves change color from end to end?
They depending on which parts of the thread are exposed to each dye vat, you end up with multiple colors on the thread. It's like a space dyeing technique. And it's a real art. In Uzbekistan, they call it aburband, which means tying the clouds. And when you see the silk cotton thread stretched out on the horizontal loom for marking, you see it's just a sea of gorgeous, pure threads waiting to be colored. They do look like clouds.
Well, that was a great question, Jason. Thank you so much for that. I want to ask about logwood, Keith. This is another source of pigment. What color does it provide, and where does it come from?
Yeah, logwood has a history in European culture because it was valued as a source of very color-fast black. which was, of course, extremely valued by certain groups, including the Catholic emperors of Spain, the Habsburg emperors of Spain, and much of the New World. It came from a particular tree in the Yucatan Peninsula, and it is the foundation of the country of Belize, believe it or not. Logging for logwood, which is later supplanted by mahogany after the invention of synthetic dyes, really was the source of the riches of the country of Belize. So these days, logwood is used not just to produce a color-fast black, but also in an alkaline environment. It produces beautiful purples, and that's really what it's valued for now. Interestingly, in a scientific context, logwood is used to dye slide samples, cell samples, because somehow, I don't know why, logwood and the DNA of the nucleus of a cell have an attraction, and it is used by people looking at it for irregular cell growth, because the way the nucleus of the cell with the DNA get tinted, you can read for abnormal growth quite easily using logwood.
Wow! So the dyeing of cells on slides is that's logwood.
Yes, and Think decades into the production of synthetic compounds, they haven't found a better one. Logwood is still used.
That's amazing. There's a reminder in this part of the book about color and class. How did they once correspond, and do they still in some parts of the planet?
That's a very good question. You know, given the time and effort that it would take to dye a garment in pre-synthetic times, it was certainly an expensive issue. So the upper classes could afford to have this sort of level of sheen and ornament and distinctiveness. And as the middle classes grew, right, with commerce, you can look at the Renaissance era, sumptuary laws came into play. So say Venice, take Venice for an example. Only certain people with certain levels of perceived class, certain levels of economic clout, could wear, for example, scarlet, which sometimes would come from cochineals, sometimes from old world insects, which were sort of equivalent to cochineal, and sometimes through madder, which is a root that would dye red. But in any case, only the rich and powerful could wear red.
So not just class, but clan or tribe as well. Is there lots of history of color grouping there, too?
Yes, there is some. I wrote a chapter in the book about a group from Bolivia called the Eorio. And the Eorio are hunter-gatherers that live in the Gran Chaco forest, which spans parts of Bolivia, Paraguay, and Argentina. And in Bolivia, groups of Eorio came out of the forest to join, quote-unquote, civilization. Hard to do air quotes on the radio. in the 70s and 90s. So these are relatively recent transitioners from a hunter-gatherer lifestyle into, quote-unquote, modernity. With them, they bring a beautiful tradition of hand-spun bromeliad fiber bags, which they call utebetai. And utebetai are, even to this day, a mark of esteem. A husband wants to carry an utebetai bag spun and looped and woven by his wife. It brings both of them a level of respect in their society. And these bags are tinted with bark, with earth, with berries, and increasingly, I have to admit, some store-bought synthetic colors, reds and blues. And the motifs on the bags and their colors would denote clan membership. And in the old days of the hunter-gatherer existence, you could tell groups of people you were at peace with or at conflict with based on the motifs and colors of their bags.
Huh. Almost like wearing, I don't want to debase this, but like gang colors up to a point.
Yeah, team colors. That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. All of these instincts that we still follow came from somewhere, didn't they?
They really did. They really did. I want to come and talk a little more directly about cochineal, because we've hit on it a couple of times. It doesn't sound very healthy for the beetles that make this, so I wonder if they're in any trouble of not being around.
You know, they are not in trouble. This kind of beetle was domesticated by the ancestors of the Zapotec thousands of years ago. Studies have shown that, in fact, it was the ancestors of the Zapotec who did this. There was some idea that it came from Peru originally, but that's based on archaeological finds of textiles in Peru being so much older than almost anywhere else. And that has to do with the arid climate, of course. But cochineal beetles love cactus. They feed on cactus. They escaped cultivation in Ethiopia and are a national pest across the countryside of Ethiopia at this point. They grow, if you really look carefully, say, at cactus plantations in drier, warmer parts of the U.S. Southwest, you might see little woolly scale insects, little white woolly specks on the paddles of these cactus. $50 down says that if you pick one of those up and squish it in your fingers, you will get a spot of red, because that's a cochineal-related species.
Wow. So this is the chapter that where you get the greatest focus on cochineal is with Juana Gutierrez Contreras and Porfirio Gutierrez. I could read this stuff all day. I mean, they've just done some amazing things. And Juana's techniques, do we even know how far back in time they go?
Well, no, we don't, in fact. It is well known that when the Spanish arrived in Mexico, they were astonished by the bright colors, the variety of colors that were in every marketplace. They were astonished by cotton, because cotton was the fiber of Central and South America, not wool. Wool came later with the Spanish. They were impressed by the dyeing of leather and feathers and the overall splendor of many people's clothing. So we know that it was all a library of natural dyes was already well in place by the 16th century, when the Spanish really arrived seriously in Mexico. So we don't really know exactly how far back it all goes, but we do know that today people like Juana can make 200 shades of natural color using dye stuffs that are traditional to her people. And you know, Juana impresses me because she does this with a notebook of about 4 pages and 10 or 11 strands of yarn. She keeps it all organized in her head.
Wow, that's amazing. Is she dictating this to somebody else so that the information stays alive?
We've been talking about this. Hasn't happened yet.
But you're hoping.
I'm hoping. I'm hoping to be present for some of the transfer of knowledge, too. You know, both because I very much respect what she does, what she knows how to do, how she does it with such respect for nature, such reverence for the gifts of the earth, and also, to be really super honest, she's an amazing cook. So spending time in and around the Gutierrez Contreras family is a total pleasure.
So Keith, as you learned the natural sources for dyes, was there one or a few that just sort of blew your mind?
One of the ones that is new to me in my research for this book, it comes from the foothills of the Himalayas in India. I got to know a woman named Rashmi Bharti, who with her husband Rajneesh Jain founded a group called Avani. And Avani was interested in preserving the weaving traditions of the Shauka people who live in the foothills of the Himalayas. And in doing this work, they came across the presence of a completely invasive weed called Ageratina adenophora, which actually made its way around the world as an ornamental garden plant from central Mexico in the 19th century. And it is a complete plague in many parts of the world, Australia being an example, certain parts of the U.S. I have it growing as a weed in my garden. Unfortunately, it's quite persistent. But Rashmi realized that this massively damaging weed to the environment could produce yellows and greens. And so they've come up with a systematic harvest, eradicating it from large tracts of land and turning it into a beautiful library of colors. And I thought, wow, there's an environmental solution, an economic solution, and it has beauty.
It is wonderful on several fronts. Yeah, there's a lot in the book, and it's just a feast for the eyes. It's called True Colors, World Masters of Natural Dyes and Pigments. It's by Keith Recker. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure.